Wednesday means our weekly visit from our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, who's been researching a pair of airliner flights from Tacoma to Alaska nearly 60 years ago that were separated by just a few months. One of those identical airliners disappeared, but the other made a dramatic, and you might even say miraculous, emergency landing. Felix is brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, this is a strange story. You know, there were two different flights from McCord, now JBLM, that were both known as Flight 293. These were both military charters of civilian airliners. And over the years on this program, we've aired stories about the Flight 293 of June 1963. That one disappeared. It crashed into the water not far from Ketchikan in South Alaska. I've spoken with a dozen people who lost family or friends on that June 1963 flight. And I've sort of, we've created this sort of informal group that gets together every now and then virtually to talk about that flight. I've often wondered about the other Flight 293, the one that left McCord 8 months earlier in October 1962. And a few weeks ago, I got a call from a man named Steve Pouliot. He's 62 and lives in Tampa, Florida.
My dad was on that flight in October. And my dad never talked about that our whole lives. And I didn't, you know, he always said, yeah, we ditched in the ocean on our way to Alaska or whatever. And that's about all I knew about it. About 20 years ago, I found an article. And, you know, he's never really expounded on it. And my dad is 87 in a nursing home now, and he lived with me for 8 months last year, and he's starting to tell stories that he never told.
And so Steve connected me with his dad, Richard Pouliot. In October 1962, he was 28 years old and was a fighter jet navigator in the Air Force, and he and his wife had four young kids. He left Minneapolis on a Sunday and headed to a new assignment in Alaska by himself. He flew out of McCord Air Force Base just before 9 a.m. on the Monday of morning, October 22nd. That was the day after the World's Fair ended, if anyone's keeping track. Mm-hmm. Now, the plane was a Northwest Airlines DC-7 four-engine propeller plane. There were 95 passengers on board, a lot of active-duty Army and Air Force, along with some dependents, you know, spouses and kids, and a crew of seven. Along with his own gear, Richard was traveling with a bag of classified documents, which was just part of the job when you fly for the Air Force, and those were stowed in the luggage compartment. They'd been in the air for about 3 hours and had just climbed to 20,000 feet when somebody announced on the intercom that there was a problem.
I don't remember the exact words, you know, but they told us we had a runaway propeller, and we kind of knew what that was. And it was on the left inboard engine, and they said that the propeller really winds up and it gets white hot, and it can either tear off and hopefully tear off free, you know, and get out of there without doing anything. Or it could chop into the good engine on the left, which means we only had two on the right side. Or it could chop into the fuselage, which means your controls to the rear are all taken care of, and, you know, you kind of fly like a rock then. So immediately started to descend to get right down close to the water. And we got down, you know, close to the water, I'd say maybe 500 feet, something like that.
So that was called, the prop was overspeeding, meaning it was spinning out of control. It couldn't be feathered or adjusted. It was getting dangerously overheated. They'd learn later this all came about as a failure of a supercharger on one of those engines. Now, the pilots radioed for help. The steward and the two stewardesses, they were called that then, prepped the passengers for a water landing. They gave everyone those Mae West life vests and told them how to brace for impact. They also moved the passengers out of the danger zone where that prop might tear off and tear through the cabin. Right. This meant that Richard Pouliot, sitting in the back, had another passenger on the floor kind of between his knees, just between him and the seat ahead of him, crammed in there. And for the next 45 minutes or so, the plane headed north over the water toward the airport at Gustavus near Glacier Bay. They didn't make it.
The prop never did tear off, but the engine just completely burst into flames. And the movement through the air brings those flames back over the wing. And the wing is where the fuel tanks are. Anyway, as soon as we caught fire, we were down there close enough to the water that he just pulled the throttles back and I think made about a 45-degree turn to the left and set it down.
I like how matter-of-fact Richard Pouliot is. Now, the landing consisted of two thumps, sort of an initial contact with the water, and then one more impact, and the thing came to a stop. And undramatically, within 5 minutes, as water began filling the cabin, the 95 passengers and seven crew members got into five rafts, inflatable rafts that were designed for just that purpose. Now, once he's on the raft, Richard Pouliot had to reach over and cut the rope where it had been tied to one of the seats so the raft could get away from the plane. He also found a dye packet in the raft and dumped it in the water to mark the crash site in case there was a search for those classified documents that he'd now lost. And so how did it feel for the seasoned aviator to get through all of that?
If I can use a a colloquial old fighter type analogy, your butt end sucks up a little seat cushion.
So as they're sitting there in the rafts, this is about 23 minutes after the plane had touched down, and maybe touchdown's a generous phrase, and about 18 minutes after everyone had evacuated, the DC-7 was getting pretty low in the water. Then it pulled a bit of a Titanic move.
Sitting there with just the dome at the top of the fuselage and the tail showing, all of a sudden the nose goes down, the tail comes way straight up out of the water, and that darn plane went straight down.
And, you know, with 45 minutes advance notice of the plane being in trouble, it didn't take that long to be rescued. First, they all climbed on a 50-foot wooden boat operated by the FAA, supplying nearby Bjorka Island. So I don't know how 100 people fit on this tiny boat. And then a big Coast Guard cutter took them all to Sitka, about 20 miles away. Now, Richard Pouliot was given access to a phone right away to report the missing classified documents. He also was able to call his wife and let her know he was okay. And that evening, resting in the hospital in Sitka, the group watched President Kennedy on TV announcing the presence of Soviet missile bases in Cuba. I mean, this is in the height of the Cold War, right? Yeah. And he had to keep going on to Elmendorf, didn't get to see his family for a year. He continued his Air Force career, and not long after ditching in Alaska, he was asked to fly a fighter plane to deliver it to Vietnam via Hawaii and Guam. That meant crossing a lot of open water, which gave Richard Pouliot pause.
Yes, you had those thoughts in the back of your mind then, but I guess somehow I needed to prove to myself I could still do it. But if you went out there, it was ejecting. You did have in your survival kit a one-man raft, but it was a big ocean. And yes, it crossed my mind.
Yeah. Well, and what a story.
It's crazy. The similarities to the Miracle on the Hudson a few years ago, that made Richard Pouliot think of that when he saw people standing on the wing of that plane in the Hudson River.
How long did the passengers get before the cabin just filled with water?
Well, as they were evacuating, there was already water on the floor of the cabin. Yeah. And by the time that they're all out within 5 minutes and they're sitting there 20 minutes later and the thing is just barely floating before it tips up into the air and sinks down. But it was all went by the book. It was described as a classic ditching and evacuation. And, you know, he and his wife have talked many times about that later flight where nobody survived and how lucky he was to be on that. And I've talked with some of the family members of people on that later flight. And it's just this luck of the draw or bad luck of the draw and this amazing courage. And just doing what needs to be done makes me wonder how I would do in something like this, just to talk to somebody who's so matter of fact. And just, what's that?
I said, all of us. It goes, you know, anytime you hear a story like this, we've all flown on planes. You know, I'm assuming that modern technology has cured the runaway propeller problem by now.
Yeah, but, you know, we had that jet not that long ago that had the problem with an engine over Colorado. So it's not, it's not perfect, but jets are so much safer than these old prop planes. Right. Prop planes had many moving parts that could go wrong. So, yeah, amazing story, an amazing, humble man who survived a crazy ditching 58 years ago.
Oh, great interview. Felix Bunnell, our resident historian. Felix, thanks very much. All his features are on MyNorthwest.com. Washington already had an addiction crisis before the pandemic, and this past year has only made it worse. Today, one King County council member is going to bring those affected by addiction together for a first-of-its-kind event, and Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott joins us live now with the details. Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Addiction is personal for King County Councilmember Reagan Dunn.
You know, this is an issue close to my heart. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I have years of sobriety under my belt. But, you know, I will tell you that getting sober for me was probably the hardest thing I've ever done. And we know that the services are desperately needed throughout our community because what we're seeing right now are double-digit increases in people turning to drugs and alcohol, new cases of abuse across the board, mental health challenges of all kinds. 40% of people in our community are reporting depression, increased levels of anxiety, in addition to this dramatic increase in drug and alcohol addiction.
Now, knowing just how difficult it was for him to take that first step to sobriety is partly what prompted Dunn to host today's first-of-its-kind event for King County.
So it's a half-day conference that we're having Wednesday at 10 o'clock. We've already got more than 100 people signed up for it, but we're really going into detail on understanding how substance use disorders have increased during COVID-19, updating folks on the science behind addiction, what we know more today than we used to, talking about issues like stigmatization of addicts and addicts also who are in recovery and the challenges that they face.
No one big area of focus?
We're going to talk about the traumatic effect that opioid epidemic is having right now in our community, what's going on with fentanyl use. And we're going to discuss some other correlation between substance use disorders and other types of criminal activity that are happening here.
The event is not just for people struggling with their own addiction.
It's a conference for all people, for any level of interest in the issue of substance use disorders, anything from people who are currently active in their addiction to parents or spouses or family members of those who need to get into recovery, to those who have recovered and are seeking a way to get back involved. It's across the board, kind of our first annual approach to this conference at an elected leader level, and I'm excited to put it on.
Ben says if not for the two or three key people supporting him when he decided to get sober, he may not have made it. And he knows that the current isolation is a struggle for others.
This pandemic has laid bare the lack of infrastructure for substance use disorders in our community, and we need to do something about it. So I thought I'm going to lend bipartisan support to increased infrastructure, more bed capacity, better treatment programs, easier ways for people to access it, reducing the cost. The cost to get into some of these facilities is just ridiculous. It can be very expensive. So all those things, let's focus on it, let's shine a light on it. And most importantly, I think, hey, it's okay. One in eight Americans suffers from the disease of alcoholism. One in six Americans from some type of addiction. And getting addicted is quite normal. And getting out of it, there is a way, there is a path, and we want to help shine the light down that pathway for others to follow.
And the goal of the event goes beyond just reaching those struggling with addiction.
Boredom is one of the major problems that leads to addiction. Stress is another, right? And so without the, you know, systems, institutions, meetings, and things in place that people have come accustomed to, there is, as we're seeing statistically, much higher a rate of that kind of addiction. And so we really want to provide a pathway for people to find help, and for those who are sober, a way to stay sober, continue to stay sober. And then from a policy perspective, we're going to have a lot of leaders in the room together. And I look forward to generating new ideas for implementation also as a result of this conference.
So where is he on the, you know, decriminalization of drugs and stuff like that?
Kind of where you hear most elected leaders at this point is that we need to address something, and we need to have more treatment and address the cost of the treatment. Kind of like he said right there, yeah. That there's not the infrastructure. We don't have it up to scale the way we need to be. So, and certainly that, you know, something hopefully will be done before the end of this legislative session. But it's not really the focus. It's not what drove this particular event. It's an interesting event. I have to say I've never seen anything quite like this put together. I want to point out this is virtual. He's really strongly encouraging anybody who feels isolated or who's maybe used to go to meetings and things like that and who hasn't had that ability because of the pandemic, mm-hmm. and maybe fell back in to relapse or something like that, to go ahead and register for this event, chime in. It can be anonymous, so you don't have to be up on the Zoom. You don't have to give your name. And you can go and you can register at kingcounty.gov/council/done. I will have something up on mynorthwest.com here shortly as well. There's going to be some speakers, too. I know one local reporter who's going to share her own story with addiction and a couple of others. And again, they're trying to find some policy and update on what they're doing in King County with some of the federal relief dollars from the federal stimulus that is going to be used also towards dealing with recovery and addiction.
But, I mean, being that Reagan Dunn is a lifelong Republican, named by his mom after Ronald Reagan, for heaven's sake, this indicates bipartisan support then for funding this and making it easier to get treatment. Am I correct on that?
Yes. Are you referring to Blake? Are you referring to the...
I'm just referring to the fact that he's a Republican. And you know, this has been a contentious debate. Do we pay for treating people who are addicted? Do we keep it as a criminal charge? Do we treat it more humanely? I mean, isn't this like a breakthrough here?
To some degree, but I think when you for this particular issue with Reagan Dunn, because of his own experience, he's always been on board with treatment. He does believe there still needs to be some criminal aspect to some degree. Part of what we'll be focused on today will be the crime that the interaction with certain crimes, specifically human trafficking, as we talk about young people, which has to do with, those who's in the sex industry, things like that, and how that drugs coincide with them getting into that industry. So that's something that I know he's quite passionate about as well, and he would want to see remain criminalized. But he also understands that there are people who just need help and that our state and this county consistently lack the resources to help those people.
Right. Hannah Scott. Hannah, thanks very much.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross, Colleen O'Brien, and Chris Sullivan. We are going to talk to a man who was incarcerated in a prison in Sullivan County, New York. His name is John J. Lennon. We have talked with him before. And just to explain to listeners your situation, he's serving 28 years to life for committing murder in the course of a drug deal. He killed the man. He has owned up to the crime. He has made a career for himself as a writer for Esquire and other publications, and is very frank about seeking parole. He would like to be allowed someday because he feels he's ready. But he also is, you've got a role for yourself as a critic of the prison system, as somebody who's been on the inside and knows what's wrong with it. And you write about the experience of being isolated in prison because of COVID, which would seem like a double isolation. But explain to me how that worked when somebody tested positive for COVID in your area.
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult social distance in prison. Look, I believe I had COVID already during the first wave. I was in Sing Sing in March of last year. One of the breakouts was in Westchester County, and Sing Sing's in Westchester County. It's an old joint, and pretty much we all got it there. About five people died, including one officer and four prisoners. I would just write and report. I mean, I'm a magazine feature writer. I'm certainly not like a gotcha journalist. I enjoy writing stories. So I don't know if I'm a critic of the system, but I mean, sometimes it's a broken system. I mean, it's a very punitive system. At any rate, I got booted out of Sing Sing, and I was transferred to a prison a little north of Westchester, which hadn't really been hit because it's a little more in a rural area. So we kind of got the second wave in the winter of 2020, 2021. And so it was the same deal. I was a little confident because I kind of knew I had some sort of antibodies. But, you know, people get tested. And you know, sometimes it's a day lag, and they'll test you, send you back to the block. And it's just like, it's like somebody described it, it's like a game of foosball. Like we're all getting it. We're just like shuffling everybody up, and it's that kind of thing. To be fair, I think corrections did the best they can with trying to keep us safe under the circumstances. I mean, that's just what it is.
But you were in, because of the COVID outbreak, you were locked down except for an hour, right?
Yeah, I mean, once they saw the numbers started picking up, they took preventative measures, which I agree with. They should lock us down. So once you're locked down, you know they let eight out at a time in the cell block, and you know you try to social distance as best you can. And if you're in your cell, you really can't spread it. But I mean, it's just so easy to still get it. I mean, my block had a bit of a breakout, but I mean, by no means was Sullivan really the worst case scenario. Over in San Quentin, they've had 30 deaths. I mean, New York, they have lower death rates, interestingly, than much of the nation's prisons. So when I report, I try to call balls and strikes.
So you feel they handled the COVID epidemic well in prison?
No, I don't. I wouldn't. You know, I wouldn't. I, you know, there's a lot of things when you say. I mean, so we live in a congregate setting, right? I mean, there's this pandemic, you know, that comes along, and you know, sort of when we first got in Sing Sing, they were on their heels. I mean, I've been pretty critical of them, but by the time that we got the second wave in Sullivan, I mean, they could only do so much, right? And I just, we're all in this, you know, everyone listening has family and friends that have been affected by this. My wife right now is in ICU because of COVID. She's 43 years old. I mean, everyone is vulnerable to this thing. So I try not to strike a whiny tone when I write about, you know, the sort of position we're in here. But at the same time, I understand I'm the voice for a lot of my peers. So, you know, I try to just deliver facts.
Explain to people who really don't think you should even have the freedom to talk why you and your peers deserve a voice.
Well, I mean, it's a good question, Dave. I mean, look, people are people. You people out there aren't good, and we're not all bad. I mean, that's a pretty oversimplified way of looking at things. And, you know, a lot of my peers sort of age out of crime. I mean, their fathers, you know, their grandfathers, because they're in prison so long. And a lot of them have developed, you know, character, and they've changed, and they try to be, you know, the best people they can be. I mean, why should we have a voice? I mean, why should I have a voice? I would like to think, you know, people appreciate a comeback story. Somebody, you know, I was involved with selling drugs, and I killed a man, and, you know, I live with that, and, you know, I carry that with me, and when I pursue journalism, it teaches me empathy. You know, I interview guys that I otherwise wouldn't, you know, and we're the only nation that keeps people in prison for decades upon decades upon decades. Two of my characters in the New York Times Magazine piece, when they walk down the hallways, they represent 80 years of prison time. I mean, we're the only nation in the developed Western part of the world that keeps people in prison that long.
If our prison system is such an outlier compared to the rest of the world, what would fix it? Or is there just something about American culture, about America's national character that is fundamentally flawed, and the only way to control crime is to lock people up as long as we possibly can?
You know, I mean, fundamentally, we have a penchant for punishment because we're a very violent nation. I think that should be acknowledged. And I could tell you firsthand, when you're a broken, empty soul, and you're involved in that lifestyle. A lot of people are broken, empty souls for whatever reason. There's a lot of layered reasons for that. And you can access guns so easily, people die. That's just what happens. In addition, I would say that prisons are run by basically guards that have worked their way up the ranks. They're not bad guys. They're decent guys. It's just the culture of who runs the joint, right? They could be very jaded people. Why are they running the prisons? Anything I got out of corrections is from volunteer programs. I got sober when people came in to bring an AA meeting. I learned how to write in a creative writing workshop, and somebody came in and hosted that when a professor came in and hosted that. That's where I learned how to write. I got an education in a privately funded college program when they were allowed to come in. I you know, to be fair, again, I call balls and strikes, to be fair, I can't really think of anything that corrections has helped me with emotionally or any kind of way.
John J. Lennon, he's the author of an article headlined, "I'm Incarcerated. This is my COVID lockdown story." It's published in the New York Times. And John, thanks for coming on. And I congratulate you for turning yourself around and getting this career. And I hope your mom is doing better.
Well, thank you, Dave Ross. You've always been very kind and followed my career. I appreciate you.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. More than 30 years after graduating from Louisiana State University, a group of fraternity brothers got together for a party. This wasn't exactly a kegger, though. It was a birthday party for their former cook, 74-year-old Jesse Hamilton.
Happy birthday, dear Jesse.
About a dozen of the former frat boys there. They showed up to a party earlier this month, but they brought a gift from nearly 100 of their fellow frat brothers. They tell the newspaper The Advocate that they had a special bond with Jesse. So at the start of the pandemic, one of the brothers called to check on her, and he found out that at the age of 74, she was still working two jobs, mostly to pay off her mortgage. So for her birthday, the brothers decided to give her a present from all of them.
90 guys have made contributions to everything that you're going to see today. They're a blessing to me. So If I could get Nessie to come up here and say, let's see what we've got behind door number one, I think we're ready to see it.
Okay, let's see what we got.
As the group gathered in her front yard, they presented her with a giant check.
Remember, Jesse told me a story a long time ago about this house and what it meant to her.
Part
of the problem with the house is it comes with bills and all kinds of stuff. Let's see what we got. They're going to pay your mortgage off.
In total, the members gave her more than $51,000.
Thank y'all.
This is yours.
Each brother donating between $600 and $1,000 on average. Before Jessie got the gift, her plan had been to continue working through her 70s, maybe even 80s, until her home was paid off. And now, Jessie says she plans to retire and take a trip to Hawaii. What a story. How wonderful those boys were taking care of her after all these
years.
See,
those frat boys are nice guys after all.
Yeah, they can be.
And now, from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon on Cairo Radio, G. Scott. We have a few sports topics here. The Seahawks are going to skip any in-person off-season activities again this year. Explain that to us.
What's going on is the NFLPA kind of got together and they did some statements. It started off with the Denver Broncos and then the Detroit Lions. And basically in that statement, they talked about with the voluntary workout period starting shortly and no acceptable resolution to our union's negotiation with the NFL over comprehensive COVID-19 protocols. They're basically saying that since it is voluntary, which is true, it is, that players are saying, hey, well, if it's voluntary and, you know, and cases are spiking, and especially here in the state of Washington, cases are spiking, there are teams and players that are saying, you know what? We're not going to come. We're going to go ahead and utilize the voluntary part of this. Now, the problem is for some star players across the NFL that have like big bonuses, like Von Johnson from the Broncos, right? He gets a lot of money. Von Miller from the Denver Broncos, he gets $1 million to show up for voluntary workouts. So is he going to show up? I'm sure he's going to.
Sure.
So this is good news and bad news, right? It's good news because some players, some of the veterans, they're like, look, I want to be here with my family. I want to spend time with my family. It's still a global pandemic. I want to continue to stay safe. And a lot of our meetings are going to be on Zoom or Microsoft Teams anyway. Right. So on that side of things, I'm good with it. The other side of it, I'm not good with it. And here's why. Sometimes you need to be protected from yourself. And some of these players, 23, 24, 25 years old, think back to when you were that age. Now, imagine you have a lot of money. Yeah. And imagine you don't have
to. Like discipline.
Some people do. And some people need to be told what to do. Yeah. I know that sounds crazy. Then some of you are self-starters and good for you. But some of us are not self-starters. Some of us are saying, oh, so I don't have to be at voluntary workouts. I'll be in Vegas or I'll be going to
but
all these different
dollars.
Places.
I mean, you got to weigh the risks.
No. Well, that's for Von. Hold on. That's for Von Miller. Not all players have that. Most players don't have that. So you have that aspect of it. And you also have the other part of it. It's like, hey, when you come back, you get to work, you kind of start getting in shape, you start doing the right things.
I don't understand why you wouldn't get it at this point. I mean, honestly, like, what's the holdup? Issue.
Why? Because we're talking about you have 23 and 24 year olds, and for some reason, 23 and 24 year olds.
They think it's like a tough stand to say I'm not going to get vaccinated. Do they think it makes them tough or something? Or what's the deal?
Now you're talking about that part of it. Now,
right.
Okay, so hold on. You're saying right now that these players should just come back and just get vaccinated. That's what you're saying. Okay, well, number one is not required for them, the player. That's number one. And number two,
I get it either, and I still got it. And I don't understand why any football player would not get it, considering the risk of the disease and the fact that they have a multi-million-dollar job to do.
Well, not all of them are multi-million dollars, though.
You
right. That's a
whole.
No, I do. I get your point, but it's not really that easy because you start talking about the NFL. It's a two-year, two and a half year career. That's how long the average NFL career lasts with the minimum salary of $600,000 a year. So it's not always multimillion, number one. But number two, some of these players, they don't – there's all different types of opinions on vaccines. You know how that is. Me, I have no problem. Colleen, you have no problem. But we also are talking about people in their 20s. It's a little bit of a difference.
I guess.
Maybe it's time to talk about the Mariners.
You just said they need to be told what to do. So, like, but now you're arguing that they're 20 and they should be able to make up their mind because they're immature and think vaccines are going to harm them. Like, I don't know your argument, G. Either they should be disciplined and told what to do, or they have their own free will and can choose not to get vaccinated.
No. You just tried to move my argument all over the place. My one argument about sometimes people, not just athletes, but everyone, some of us need to be told what to do. Some people can work on their own, and some people can't work on their own. And so I'm saying for some of these NFL players, it's good in the sense that some of them, maybe they might be self-starters, and they want to be with their family. That's great. But some of them will take this time to, A, get out of shape, and B, go out there and spend money, and they probably would have wished that they would have shown up for that voluntary workout.
Okay. Yeah. I got one more question to ask.
What do you got?
What do you think about seven inning baseball?
I love it.
Yeah?
I love
it. Should it just be that way?
Yes, it should.
Really?
Yes. It should. Well, how about this? When's the last time that you've watched an entire baseball game?
You're asking the wrong guy.
Okay, well, even a casual baseball fan might not watch it all, and especially a lot of the games here that start at 7:10 here in Seattle. Yo, come on now. How many of you guys go to sleep by the eighth inning?
And could the players rise to the occasion? Could they, you know, get into the game? Because it seems like it takes them like two or three innings to get into the game sometimes.
Yeah, I love seven-inning baseball. I think it should be seven-inning baseball. I think they should move the fences in a little bit so there can be more home runs. Baseball is in my opinion, it was my first love. I love baseball. But I totally fell out of love with baseball. It's just boring. There's no spice in it at all. You know how it is. You need spice in relationships.
All right. Yeah. G. Scott joins Ursula at 9 o'clock. By the way, Mariners are at 6-5 now, tied for second place in the AL West. The latest audit finds that the total amount of fraud at the State Unemployment Office could be over $1 billion, but it is being disputed, and let's go to Kyrita's Hannah Scott to find out why.
And it is being disputed from ESD. So basically what happened was our state auditor, Pat McCarthy, came out yesterday with a couple of audits on ESD as well as a report looking into a variety of different things that happened last year from the fraud, from the Nigerian fraud scammers, also some just fraudulent claims that were paid out to individuals who were misrepresenting their qualifications to actually get unemployment benefits. And that includes, by the way, there's a law enforcement investigation. This came out yesterday into an ESD employee who was still working, but was paid benefits during all of this last year. They did not disclose either the auditor or
so an actual employee of the department who was getting unemployment while employed at the unemployment department.
Yeah. Exactly. Showing up to work and that nobody caught that. So the ESD couldn't say too much about that. They, including the dollar amount. So we don't know how much that is. So that's one aspect. The disputed thing here, though, is that the auditor said so $640 million is what we know that ESD has already said was fraudulent last year that was paid out. And they got about half of that back. They were able to recover. But the auditor recognized a little over $460 million, I believe it was, that was questionable and added that to that 640, which is where you get this $1.1 billion number from. So that's what was in the audit. And then ESD immediately fired back with a response yesterday in a statement after this came out saying, no, look, half of those have been resolved, and those could be listed as questionable just for a variety of different reasons. It could be that somebody who was, you know, applying didn't get back to us in time, things like that. So the auditor's position was this, and she had come out and said before that ESD was dragging its heels when these audits began, not willing to give over documents and let her see all that she needed to see. So it could be that it's miscommunication and that you know, that number, that dollar amount isn't involved in this. Whatever the case, it's clear that she didn't have all of the information she needed and that ESD had not been forthcoming. That's why that number is in there. So we'll have to see how that plays out. In the end, though, there's still a lot of concerns. There was 90% of people who never got through when they tried to call to get when they were having a problem with their claims. They never, ever got through. The average wait time, 2 hours for anybody who did get through. Website was no better. There was steps that could have been taken to avoid the fraud that ended up happening. All of those things are in these audits in this report. And this unemployment filer said he wasn't surprised. What is?
I'm frustrated. I got a letter 1st of April saying that I qualified for benefits for unemployment.
Trouble was, he was still working then until July of last year when he truly did need to receive benefits. But when he tried to sign up, he tells Cairo 7 TV,
I found out my account was locked.
And so many other people had that same issue and waited months. Some people are still waiting to get those payments. Now, the state auditor, Pat McCarthy, was asked whether mismanagement, bad luck, or something else was to blame.
Well, I think it's a combination of things, and that's what the audit tries to bring out into the forefront.
This taxpayer knows who he blames.
Governor Inslee was the CEO of the state when this all happened, and he needs to be held accountable for that.
In the meantime, we have the new head of the ESD because Susie Levine now left and is working for the Biden administration. The new head of ESD admitted, she told the Times yesterday, we still have issues with people trying to get through. We're working on it. One thing the auditor did point out at the end of the audit was we have more federal unemployment dollars coming in 2021, and she's not confident that the ESD is necessarily made enough changes to be ready to deal with that and not have some similar issues with backlogs and things like that.
Okay. Moving
kind of
on.
Moving on. So, meantime, as we know, there's this push to get everyone vaccinated. It continues. And some are concerned about the possibility of rules that could require people to show proof of vaccination. Among them, Republican Representative Jim Walz, who's introduced a late session bill targeting the potential vaccine passports.
What the bill does is it says that in the state of Washington, no public entity, no state agency, no local agency can require paperwork or a proof of a vaccination of COVID or any related virus for admission to any public space or any privately owned space that is open to the public.
He tells Cairo Radio's Dory Monson exactly what that means.
At a venue that's open to the public, they can't demand papers. But in a private home that isn't usually open to the public, or at a business that isn't usually open to the public, a private office environment, there they could do it. But in a venue that's generally open to the public, that's a public accommodation, okay, they could not demand papers, and no public law enforcement could enforce such a demand.
So that means like hotels or stadiums could not require vaccine passports.
Exactly. Yes. Walz says that he believes this is they're going to maybe offer this as a carrot to encourage people who are reluctant to get a vaccine to reverse course.
We can't let fear or any emotion define our public policy and erode our foundational rights. I mean, this country was founded on the idea that reason and fundamental liberties are what should drive what a government does. And mostly limit what a government does. And we're losing that thread. And I'm hoping there is a silver lining to all this, that all of this overreaction, all of this erosion of rights is going to reawaken in people the understanding, the appreciation for the foundational rights that built this state and built this country. So I'm optimistic in the long run. It just may be some choppy flying between here and there.
Now, I did get a chance to ask Governor Inslee about the possibility of requiring proof of vaccination last week.
We haven't given any serious consideration of that. I think over time you might see private entities, airlines, others might, you know, might be adopting their own sort of requirements in their private businesses. That's something that is outside the can of government. So you may see that inquiry increasingly in your life, even if it's not a government activity. But we haven't given any serious consideration to that.
Well, but Representative Walz is right. This is just a message to those who don't get the vaccine. Go out at your own risk, because we're not going to require passports at these big public venues when they reopen. And if you're not vaccinated, then tough. That's on you.
Right. So, and I think that you will see some places, somebody brought up that, you know, maybe on airlines, you might have to show something like this, and then it becomes a state thing. And so the state could have to get involved that way. We'll have to see what happens. I can tell you, as far as the Representative Walz's bill, it's got no legs at this point. It was introduced April 5th, far too late. He was hoping to start some discussions in the interim and bring it up next year. So it'll be interesting to see where we're at with all of this discussion, you know, come next session, and whether this becomes a necessity, this kind of bill.
Adam Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM, or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.